I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, June 2nd. This week marks 100 years since the Tulsa Race Massacre, in which historians say a coordinated attack on the so-called Black Wall Street neighborhood of Greenwood in Tulsa left as many as 300 black people dead, 10,000 homeless, and 40 square blocks of the neighborhood destroyed. Those numbers, according to historians cited in the Washington Post. And we'll go over some of that history here, too. But mostly in this segment, we'll ask this question about the present. After that kind of human rights atrocity, which included at least government complicity in its failure to stop the massacre, if not direct participation, what are the generational effects of all the wealth that was destroyed in that wealthy black neighborhood? What does it add up to in dollars and cents, and what reparations are rightly owed? There is both a bill in Congress and a lawsuit seeking reparations on behalf of descendants of Tulsa Massacre victims, as well as three actual survivors, ages 101 to 107, who are still alive. Their names are Viola, Mother, Fletcher, Hughes, Uncle Red, Van Ellis, and Lessie, Mother Randall, Benningfield, Randall. I guess when you get to 100 years old, everybody has a nickname. And justice for them in the form of reparations became an issue at this week's commemoration. As the Washington Post reports, the premier event on Monday, a concert organized by the Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission, was abruptly canceled over the question of reparations. The event, called Remember and Rise, was supposed to feature a performance by John Legend and a keynote speech by voting rights activist Stacey Abrams, but lawyers representing those last known massacre survivors said the celebrities pulled out after the commission failed to address requests that it use some of its funds to compensate them, the three 100-year-olds, for what they lost during the rampage. In a minute, we'll talk to the Washington Post reporter who wrote that story. But also, some of you have heard the first episode of a new WNYC podcast series with the History Channel called Blind Spot, Tulsa Burning. It ends like this, does episode one, with our host, WNYC's Calla Leah.
For the descendants of the massacre of Greenwood, there has been no justice, no restitution. The people who were responsible have never been held accountable. But right now, the city of Tulsa is confronting its past like never before. Public schools are finally including the massacre in their history curriculum. There's a new lawsuit calling for reparations. And archaeologists have discovered mass graves that they believe contain bodies of massacre victims. And what they find could answer the questions that have haunted the city for a century. What would it take to make it right? To allow Tulsa to truly heal from this painful past? And what would the city and our country look like if they succeed?
What would it take to make it right? And what would the city of Tulsa and the country look like if they succeed? Check out Blind Spot Tulsa Burning wherever you get your podcasts. It's amazing. And with us now are WNYC Blind Spot host Calla Leah and Washington Post correspondent Deneen Brown, who's been covering Tulsa developments. Deneen and Calla Leah, good morning, and thanks so much for coming on.
Good morning,
Brian. Good morning. It's great to be here.
Calla Leah, we'll play a clip from the middle of the episode later, but we started with your ending there. No spoiler alert necessary in this case, because the story of Tulsa, the story of our country, is not over. But what are some of the answers you're getting to the question you posed at the end there? What would it take to make it right? And what would the city of Tulsa and the country look like if they succeed?
Oh, wow, that's a big question. But I think, you know, to put it simply, if you harm someone, then doing the right thing means apologizing, right? And rebuilding trust and doing whatever it takes to make that person who was harmed feel good in their body. And I think the descendants and the survivors of the Tulsa Race Massacre have been just asking for repair, restitution, redress, and that can be in the form of if you burn or destroy someone's home, then you should provide them with a home of equal or better value. And so I think for me, just in reading about this and talking to many of the descendants, they just want, one, for people to be held accountable, the people who either sat by and watched this happen or allowed it to happen, and also the actual perpetrators or descendants of those perpetrators who, you know, stole things, stole personal property, who destroyed their homes, for those people to be held accountable, to an investigation to be enacted. So I think, one, the big thing, accountability, and two, you know, for them to have their, to get their things back, you know, their homes, their community. If you destroy a community, then you should be responsible for rebuilding that community.
Mm-hmm. Deneen from the Washington Post, can you tell us more about how that premier event on Monday came to be canceled? Who asked for what kinds of reparations from the commission organizing the commemoration, and what was their response?
So the plans to for the Centennial Commission, which is a city-sponsored commission that was organized or created to create events to commemorate the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. That commission has raised more than $30 million for the events and also for a museum called Greenwood Rising. The lawyers who were representing these three survivors, as you mentioned, Viola Fletcher, who's 107, Leslie Randall, who's 106, and Viola Fletcher's little brother, Hughes Van Ellis, who's 100. The lawyers for those survivors sent in a list of seven requests. The request included ensuring that the survivors receive some money while they're still alive, some direct support for the survivors who are living in abject poverty. They said that they did not request what the commission said it requested. But those negotiations broke down between the Centennial Commission and the lawyers representing the survivors. That those negotiations broke down around Thursday, perhaps Wednesday of last week. And the Centennial Commission announced on Thursday night that it could not proceed with this concert that was going to feature singer and songwriter John Legend and also a keynote speaker by Stacey Abrams out of Georgia. So I got word on Thursday night that the celebrities had pulled out after these negotiations broke down. And so that left a number of people in the city who were looking forward to seeing John Legend, you know, dejected. But also the lawyers for the survivors say that they should be paid reparations. They should receive some money, as Kalia said, for what they lost. And they're living in poverty while the Centennial Commission has raised millions of dollars. And the lead attorney who's filed a reparations lawsuit against the city and state officials say that even as the Centennial Commission raised $30 million, not a dime has gone to these survivors. Not 1 cent has gone to these survivors who, as you said, are over 100 and living in poverty.
Kelly, I want to play for people a one-minute stretch of the podcast that features a descendant of a Greenwood Massacre survivor who now gives tours, this descendant does, of the Greenwood area, named Chief Eginwale Amashan. And listeners, you'll hear him talking to people on the tour in this clip, interspersed with him talking about giving the tour. It starts with him on the tour saying what that Black Wall Street neighborhood was like.
You could go do any and everything within walking distance in the Greenwood District. Most people have no idea that the original Cotton Club was right here in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
The one in New York. We start right in the core, in the heart of Greenwood. And I show people what was and what is no more.
This is the location of the Stratford Hotel. In 1918, this was declared the crown jewel of hotels in the United States of America, owned by a black man.
I take them to the places where bodies were dumped. I take them to the home of Wyatt Tate Brady, the city founder, Klansman.
He said, yes, I'm a member of the Klan. I'm a proud member of the Klan. So is my father a member of the Klan.
So that they can see that he built a home that is the replica of Robert E. Lee. I take them to Standpipe Hill.
So they occupied these hills and fought for their lives.
The battleground location where black men fought to defend Greenwood. This explains why it was necessary to bomb Greenwood. Because it was a losing battle on the ground.
Kalalea, can you pick it up right from there? What do historians say was the nature of that battle on the ground? And what was that bombing from the sky that Amashan refers to?
Yeah, well, it's an age-old story of a accusation that a young black man named Dick Rowland, who was a 19-year-old teenager, assaulted a young white woman named Sarah Page in an elevator. And that's essentially a lot of rumors spread. The Tulsa Tribune, which is a white-owned newspaper, put out an article to say nab that black man, that Negro, who assaulted a girl in an elevator. And people were outraged, as they were, especially in that time. A lot of white people, crowds of them, came to a courthouse. And there was a struggle and a fight ensued. And a gun went off, somebody shot somebody else, and just everything erupted from there pretty much. And the next 16 to 18 hours in Tulsa, starting in downtown Tulsa, with those same groups of people basically looting downtown Tulsa for ammunition, taking their valuables, taking guns and weapons, and then moving across the tracks into Greenwood. And then at 5 a.m., a very coordinated attack. And that's when you hear about the bombing, where allegedly, it appears as such because there's enough eyewitness accounts of this, mm-hmm. airplanes that were dispatched were dropping turpentine bombs and incendiary bombs from the sky onto the roofs of these homes and businesses, thousands of businesses. And Brian, I think what I really want people to understand is if you just look on your own block and think about the block in which you live, we're talking about 35 to 40 block radius here. This is not just one block of homes burned with businesses on your home. Just think about that. 35 of these, you know, so it's a huge, it's a really large community. And it was almost like, I say this and I know it's cliche, but it really does look like it was a war zone when you look at the pictures after. So the destruction, the level of destruction, the callousness that happened after the massacre is also quite upsetting, from people not being able to hold funerals or bury their dead. I just read a story. I read one story a day about somebody who survived the massacre, mm-hmm. just to start off my morning. And the story I read today is about a family who owned a store on Elgin Street, and their home was totally destroyed. And she writes about her German Shepherd dog who also was burned in the fire. And it was probably one of the first stories that I had read about someone's pet being mm-hmm. harmed or being mm-hmm. killed. And so I think we have to think about this. You're talking about smoke, the smell of burning flesh, the smell of, you know, it was a war zone. It was really an awful place. So that battle, the thing that made Tulsa really different, and I'm 99% sure of this, is that there was no lynchings of a black man in Tulsa up to that point. And so the black veterans who had just returned from the war were determined to keep it that way. And they went down to the courthouse to defend Dick Rowland. And that's where the fight ensued, because you had these men who just got home from war, they were treated very differently in France and other parts of the country and the world. And they came back and they were, you know, had a certain sense of dignity and pride about themselves. And they were determined to fight back. You know, so this is also a story about destruction, but also a story about resistance, Black resistance. Yeah.
So here's a further description of the events of 100 years ago, as spoken yesterday by President Biden, the first sitting president to ever visit Tulsa and acknowledge the history.
A mob tied a Black man by the waist to the back of their truck with his head banging along the pavement as they drove off. A murdered Black family draped over the fence of their home outside. An elderly couple knelt by their bed praying to God with their heart and their soul when they were shot in the back of their heads. Private planes dropping explosives. The first and only domestic aerial assault of its kind on an American city here in Tulsa.
President Biden yesterday in Tulsa. Kalalea, elsewhere in the speech, Biden said something that you also bring up in the podcast, that it wasn't a riot, it was a massacre. Why is that distinction important?
Well, I mean, a riot, as I say in the podcast, would denote that it was mutuality or a mutual event, right? And it was random. And a riot breaks out, I'm mad at you, you're mad at me, we go head to head, we're on equal playing field. A massacre involves airplanes. It means that the fire department decides or is threatened not to put out the flames of your home. It also means that the sheriff and the police department seem not to be available. A 5 a.m. signal that rings out where thousands and thousands of white people start running towards your community at a certain time of the day at 5 o'clock in the morning. That was planned. That sounds like a plan to me. And it reads as such. So I think the word riot back then was used because, you know, the Red Summer of 1919 and even the years leading up to the Red Summer, insurance companies would not pay out policies if it was for a riot, if there was a riot that occurred there. So I think it was for an economic side of things. That's why they used the word riot, so that many insurance companies were not obligated to pay out policies. Mm. And that was written, and that has not happened. There's thousands. There were, you know, so many people who tried to get their policies paid, and because of that riot clause, that did not happen. And so if the word riot is apropos, I mean, excuse me, the word massacre is apropos because that's exactly what it was. You know, when you go and harm people who are helpless and defenseless, like you said, like President Biden said, kneeling down on your knees to pray and being shot in the head, that's a massacre, right? Killing somebody's animals, that's a massacre. Shooting people as they run out of their burning homes, that's a massacre. So it's undeniable at this point. We have enough evidence to prove it to be that way.
Janine in Northern Virginia, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hey, Brian. I've been doing some entertainment journalism, and I was able to interview for Black Girl Nerds, an online publication, Stanley Nelson and Marco Williams, the directors of the film. And also this year, I was able to interview Michelle Durster, the writer of Ida B. the Queen. She's Ida B. Wells' great-great-granddaughter, who was documenting. She became a journalist because of lynchings. Then I interviewed the filmmaker who did the lynching of Anthony Crawford in Abbeville, South Carolina, who was an African-American man who basically was self-sustaining a town in South Carolina at the same time period. And he spoke up about pricing when he took his stuff. He was supporting his whole community, and they made more money than the white community, and they lynched him, and they actually took all of his land, and they his relatives out of town. And there were hundreds of black people in Abbeville, South Carolina, whose land was stolen. There are thousands of stories of white folks taking the wealth of black folks during the Reconstruction era and into the early 20th century. So, you know, I appreciate these journalists as you are down there. And when I spoke to Stanley Nelson and Marco, I asked them, how do you process the trauma of having to watch this footage? I also asked the other filmmaker, how do you process the trauma as black people, as storytellers? And Stanley Nelson said, well, you have to ask my wife. I don't know. I just keep working. And Marco was like, I just have to keep telling the story because I'm up to my neck. It's virtually killing me. I just did an interview with a current black woman whose son was shot, and she became in Philadelphia. She became a politician. Her first son was shot in 2016. Her second son was shot and killed just this year. So this is continuing. And as we are telling these stories, we are traumatized. This country continues. Even the gentleman that spoke before, how he spoke was traumatizing because white folks can't even speak about how much of their wealth it has been taken, of this country has been built on the blood, literally, and the bones of black people. And this is the last thing I want to say. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, this is the part they never say. He said, instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds and all the great opportunity of this nation. So we have come to cash this check, a check that will come, that will give upon us the demands of riches and freedom and the security of justice. So, you know, we need to elevate that part of the I Have the Dream speech, and we need to continue. The reparations mean like student loan debt absolution for black people is what I would say. So that's all, y'all. I thank you, ladies, for your wisdom, and the podcast is brilliant. And I thank you, Brian, for elevating this story.
Janine, thank you much. Keep calling us. Wow.
Thank you.
Kalalea, would you just wrap it up by telling people what's coming up on the podcast series, WNYC's Blind Spot, Tulsa Burning? This is a 6-part series that we're doing with the History Channel that you're hosting, and it's only episode 1 that dropped yesterday. So you want to just give yourself a little promo on the way out the door?
Sure. We have a lot happening. Like I said, this was not an isolated event. So we're going to go a little bit into the history, a bit about after what happened during the war, the Great War, the World War I. And then we'll touch on that there were two wars being had, one here in the U.S. and another overseas. So we'll touch on that and a little bit about Black resistance, which I mentioned earlier. And what I'm really, really excited to share is that I am going to be speaking with a trauma therapist who deals with racialized trauma, because as I think Janine just questioned, this has been very hard. This has been probably the toughest project or story I've worked on. I cry a lot. And I think it's really important for all of us to kind of like work through this trauma so that these things are not repeated. So it was really important for me to like talk to somebody who works, that does this kind of work. And I'm really excited for you, Brian, and for everyone to listen to that interview.
Janine Kalalea, thank you both so much.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Janine.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Bye-bye.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.